Welcome to the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 33 for the week of July 8th, 2009.
Welcome back to the Experience Points Podcast. I'm George Alboy.
I'm Scott Juster.
And we also have a guest today, if you noticed from the introduction. His name is Nels Andersen. Nels, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, hey, we're very happy to have you. So just a quick introduction for people who may not know Nels. He writes his own blog, Above 49. He's also a developer in Vancouver, Canada. He works for Hothead Games, and Hothead did the Penny Arcade game on the Rainslick Precipice of Darkness. They did the Braid Mac port. They're currently working on Death's Bank, a new game from Ron Gilbert. Yeah. Nels is often also contributes to the game design aspect of the month, so he's a pretty prolific guy. Nels, why if we miss something, Nels, why don't you just go ahead and fill us in?
No, I think that's about right.
How long have you been working for Hothead, Nels?
I've been at Hothead for about half a year now. And yeah, so, I started back in February.
And so in your time there, were you working on the Penny Arcade stuff? Are you doing the Ron Gilbert?
Yeah, I've actually been on Death's Bank the whole time I've been there.
Oh, man. That means we can't ask you too many questions because, well, you'd have to kill us if you released it.
Drive down there, pump some poison gas into your house. Yeah. Something like that.
Does something smell funny, George?
Yeah. No. Also, how long have you been a developer as a profession?
I've been a general software person. I got my master's degree in computer science from the University of British Columbia up here in the fall of 2007, and I started working then. But I got into games about a year after graduation. There was a debacle with immigration because I'm originally American and work permits and all this other stuff. So I was working for a web startup that I'm very glad I no longer work for.
Well, happy 4th, by the way, for the listeners and Nels, if you consider yourself still American.
Yeah, maybe you've left the land of liberty and now the great white north. I'll have to wish you a belated happy Canada Day.
Yeah. That's right. It's good for both.
Yeah. A very Canadian response, my friend.
That's right.
Before we get into the topics, I'm always interested, especially when we talk with game designers, to hear about what their biggest influences are. Because, you know, the people that make the games also, I'm assuming, play a lot of them and were inspired to start making them because of their favorites. So off the top of your head, are there any games that continue to inspire you when you're making your games, you know, in either a negative or a positive way?
that's hard, right?
Or maybe an easier way to say it is, what's the last game that really impressed you when you were playing it?
So the last one that probably really, really impressed me, if I look over the stuff I've recently played on Steam, it'd probably have to be Far Cry 2. Mm-hmm. Like, as is evidenced when I was just writing about playing the game through with sort of a permanent death setting, which is an idea that was actually proposed by an Aussie blogger named Ben Abraham.
Yeah.
And his site is drgamelove.blogspot.com, and he proposed this, but I was like, that's a fantastic idea. I should do this too. And I was able to race to the bottom faster than anybody else. And it was actually like, it was really profound in a way that I wasn't really expecting. Mm-hmm. So that was excellent. In terms of general inspiration, I mean, there's lots and lots of digital games that I love, but I sort of got into it. Like, I've played video games ever since I was a kid, but the thing that really got me interested in making them was actually playing tabletop RPGs.
Oh, good choice.
George has just fallen in love with you.
So, you know, starting with D&D, the Dark Sun and Planescape settings especially, and then, you know, Mage and Call of Cthulhu and all that other stuff. And I ended up, I was heavily involved with the third edition conversion, fan site conversion of the Dark Sun setting. And that was really, got my hand into, like, the guts of making games and understanding, like, the relationship between rules and aesthetics. It's like, you know, we want to have this character class, whatever, feel this way, but we need to represent it through the rules. And that combined with, you know, a prior love for video games are sweet, I was like, well, hey, this is an appealing thing.
Yeah.
Do this.
Yeah. It's cool that you mentioned the Far Cry 2 permadeath playthrough, because today's articles that we're going to be talking about involve Clint Hocking, who's the creative director for Far Cry 2, as well as Manvir Hare. He's a designer who works at Raven Software. Right now they're doing the remake of Wolfenstein. And they were had a little they had some cross blogging action about how to design ethical dilemmas in games, as well as the best ways to implement those dilemmas once you've decided on making a choice. And so I guess we should summarize the articles a little bit for folks, because they're a little, you know, they're pretty broad and high level concepts. I mean, Clint Hocking really doesn't do anything halfway. Like when he talks about things, like if he's going to write about something, like it's always really well thought out. And the same goes for Manvir, actually. He uploaded his slides. But I mean, to distill it to the most basic level, they were talking about how to make choices in video games matter in a way that goes beyond an optimization problem.
Right.
Thinking about choices that matter as far as ethics, rather than just choices that matter as far as getting the most HP or the most experience points or finishing the game the fastest.
Right.
And so they had a couple different ways of doing that. Manvir was, and the thing that actually started most of the conversation was Manvir was saying that there needs to be some way to enforce permanence in these decisions, which really set off the whole discussion. And you know, like if you make a decision in a game, the idea that you can just go and reload it or restart and do that decision again undercuts how much of an impact that has. And I think that's like what the crux of the argument was about. And I mean argument in a very, you know, in a very congenial way. I mean, these were good conversations, but so Nels, how do you feel about that? Like, I think the permanence thing is something good to start with.
It is, and it's hard. I mean, so I was talking about this with some other designers recently, and it's very clear that when that sort of permanence is enforced, that the you know, the kind of decisions you make do become a lot more resonant. Mm-hmm. I haven't played Fable 2, but a couple of the other guys I was talking to had, mm-hmm. and they were talking about how, like, because in Fable 2, the decisions you make are permanent, I believe. Have you guys played it?
George, you have.
Yes. They're permanent. Go ahead.
Yeah, so you make it, and then even if you reload, like, if you play back through, it just kind of automatically makes that same decision you already made. Something along those lines, right?
How does that enforce that, George?
I haven't actually done that. I've never reloaded.
So you're trying to say you're too good to try to reload?
Well, I'm okay with permanence, uh-huh. so it's not something that I've tried to get around.
That's interesting.
At least in Fable 2.
Well, I mean, I know there are some points in Fable 2 where you can't go back, you know.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. Mm. Maybe it automatically saves, and I don't know exactly how the mechanics shake out, but I definitely got the impression from these guys, at least, that the decisions they were making felt very, very permanent, and thus felt like, okay, this is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the things that occurs in Fable 2 very early on is the decision about what you do. There's a certain aspect, I'm not going to spoil it for people who haven't played it, mm-hmm. but there's certain decisions you make as a child in the game uh-huh. that affect how the city looks and people behave towards you in the future. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think would pretty dramatically change the game. I haven't played through it twice, mm-hmm. but it's something where you are consistently reminded of the choices you made earlier in the game. So even if you could reload, the fact that you're existing in a world that has clearly been affected by your choices, mm-hmm. I think gives you that at least the illusion of permanence.
Oh, that's interesting. You can approach it from an artistic way, because even if they're not permanent, and let's say you could, for the sake of argument, let's say you could reload your game, it might feel like you're kind of betraying the world that you created, because it's so tailored to what you did.
Right.
It's a way of doing permanence without being draconian about it.
Yeah. So based on sort of Manvir and Clint's conversation, like, I think a lot of folks realize that sort of the way that most games are implemented now, where you get to like a big decision point, lots and lots of players will just, you know, you quick save right before mm-hmm. you try one, you see what happens, you quick save, you try the other. I mean, I do this all the time too, right? like it's lots of people have different ideas about why this is. I kind of believe that sort of this notion of opportunity cost factors into it. So basically, like, when all, you know, in real life, right, all the decisions we make have this big opportunity cost where if I do A, I won't be able to do B. Mm-hmm. And sort of games remove that.
Yeah.
So there's this sort of like, you know, there's this freedom that you don't have in real life. So people want to make all these zero opportunity cost decisions. But I think it does sort of dampen that emotional resonance, because then when you make all the decisions, then you kind of like made none of them, right? Yeah. Like,
yeah. You don't have to live with any of the consequences of it.
Exactly. Or you just pick the one that, you know, that is best. But that's not how real life works, right? Like, you know, when you take the job or go to graduate school, like, you don't get to see how both would play out and then pick the one that you like better.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to go forward and just say that even the opportunity to look at where those decisions are going to is, at least in some way, shape, or form, interactive enough with those ethical choices. So I'm thinking way back, right, when I was maybe 9, and I'm reading those Choose Your Own Adventure novels, and you put your fingers at all the pages,
oh, yes,
and you can go back later. It's kind of a way for, maybe for children, but definitely for my younger self, to test what those paths lead to, and in hopes of learning, right, in hopes of taking my preconceived notions about what's going on in the book to make it so that I play better in the future, right? So at some point, being able to test ethics is really healthy. Yeah. If I can say, I'm going to be able to look at the outcome of one ethical decision and see if it's what I would want, so that in the future, when that ethical decision pops up again, and this is something that happens in real life all the time, we're faced with decisions that we thought we've already made, or, you know, very real life decisions that repeat themselves throughout our lives. Mm-hmm. It's kind of helpful to be able to look back and say, well, I made that mistake once before, I'm not going to make it again.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and I don't think that any, at least none of the folks just sort of discussing this, think that this is that all games should have this notion of permanence, that you can't undo these decisions. It's just that Manveer says, you know, to make these decisions more affecting and more meaningful, that the permanence is needed. And sort of Clint takes the opposite tack. I'm trying not to put words in these guys' mouths, based on what I read, that Clint takes the opposite tack and says, you know, the whole the save load thing in games is a fundamental game thing, and that instead of trying to, you know, short circuit it or get around it, rather we have to find a way to use that to make these games, to make these decisions, you know, more resonant.
It's hard to even conceive of the kind of structure that Hawking is talking about, because it doesn't really exist, as far as I know. I mean, at the same time, he's saying that save and load is crucial, but save and load. I agree with Manveer to a certain extent that the quick save load undercuts any kind of impact that the decisions have. And even in his games, even in Far Cry, there's times in Far Cry where I did a save and load, but Far Cry is set up to function without the save and load. Like, that's what the buddies are for. That's what the branching mission structures are for. But even in a game that provides that option for the player, I still found myself doing quick save and load because I had that option. And if he had taken that away from me, it might have meant more to me, because I would have utilized the buddies more and I would have utilized the branching structures more.
Hmm. Right.
It's weird, because I feel like in a way that game was kind of towards what he was trying to argue for, but it couldn't quite break itself of the quick load and quick save. And I feel like they're almost kind of opposite in a way.
I have a quick, I mean, it's a slight tangent, but it's a question for both of you. Yeah. And that is, if you were to play through a game a second time, and say, for example, Manveer's permanence is part of the game.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you played it through a second time to see what the other ethical decision, maybe the big choice, what the result is. Do you think that the second one would be less meaningful because you've already seen the first option? And alternatively, do you think that the first option would lose some of its weight because you now know what was the other outcome?
Like, I think it's not quite as dramatic, because if you sort of imagine, like, each playthrough is a possible world or whatever, that when you sort of take that story from beginning to end, that still feels like a self-contained thing. And if you do it again, making different decisions, it still feels like its own self-contained thing. But if you're just marching to a point, trying all three paths, picking one, continuing on, doing that at every, that seems like it's less of a continuous, like, whole experience that conveys some whatever.
Yeah.
I was gonna actually have a bit of a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Do you remember any like big ethical type decision in game that you actually found like quite poignant, quite meaningful, really difficult to make? Because when I was reading these, I was trying to think of one. I'm not sure how many I can think of. Like maybe the end of Deus Ex, but what I did was when I got to the end, I picked the one that I thought, you know, that was the most interesting, watched it, loaded, try the other one, load it, try the other one. So even then, it's like kind of a big deal, but at the same time, kind of not.
We're getting back to that problem that George brought up of like keeping your thumb in the other page of the Choose Your Own Adventure book. And
Right.
it's hard to make anything. That's why I keep coming back to this idea that it has to have some kind of long-term effect. I mean, George, what do you think? Like, has there been a game that really affected you like that?
It's strange because there are games that I'm thinking of now where the character makes an important choice, but I was not involved in that. That was not, it was never up to me. Something like Final Fantasy or, you know, some of the RPGs that are particularly memorable to me. The only thing that comes to my mind, other than BioShock, which I think we'll get to soon enough, is Left 4 Dead, actually, in the choice of whether or not to go back and save my friends.
No. So that's slightly different, but that's a very, very important thing to note, right? Like, I think what Clint and Manveer are talking about were primarily single player experiences. And I think that this is actually an easier problem in multiplayer games because it's really hard to make the characters, for a lot of players, it's very hard to make the players care about things that everyone knows are fake, right? Like they're just pixels ultimately, and some people can get really emotionally invested and then, you know, have those decisions have great gravitas, but most people don't. But when you put another real actual human being into the equation, that completely changes things. Like when I think about, you know, big hard decisions I made in games, a lot of them were when I was, you know, I had to have the WoW needle in my arm and I was thinking about stuff with other players or other people in the guild, and like that was, you know, big, kind of heavy stuff.
I just thought of one while we were talking.
Shoot.
In Chrono Trigger, there's a point where I don't know if have you guys played Chrono Trigger, George? You
Yes.
played it. Nels, have you played
Yeah,
Chrono
yeah.
Trigger? Okay, so at the point where Frog confronts Magus, and you have the option whether to fight Magus or you have the option to, you know, forgive him basically and stop seeking revenge. One choice means he joins your party. The other choice means that you fight him, and if you kill him, he's dead. That's it. He doesn't become a
Right.
party member. The first time I played through that game, it didn't even occur to me that he would join my party. And the way I was role playing it, I felt that Frog finally had his chance for revenge, and so I fought him and killed him. And then the next time I played through, I was like, oh, well, maybe this time around, you know, I'll see what happens. You know, Frog, you know, I read Frog a little bit as a different character. He seemed more capable of forgiveness. And so I said, oh, you know, there's no point in fighting. What's done is done. And then all of a sudden I got this new character. And it meant that's probably the closest I can come to it, to where an ethical decision actually had some kind of impact on
Okay,
me.
so I think this is interesting because I had the opposite action occur, right? I was playing it as Frog and I figured that he would not fight him and he joined my party and I did not see it as a choice. I thought that was actually inevitable. So when I learned that you could kill him, it gave it more meaning. And so in this aspect of it, right, your decision, the first decision, is more meaningful because you saw what happened on the other side.
Oh, so maybe the only one of the crucial ways of defining an ethical decision as meaningful is to know that there's a plurality of outcomes.
And I think that we
I think
imagine,
so.
I think we imagine an alternative outcome whether or not we see it in the game. So I'm not so sure that even making it a permanence issue, even if it is a permanence mechanic in the game where you can't see the multiple outcomes, I think you're still imagining what's going on potentially on the other side.
That's true.
That could be. That was very interesting. That's actually not a bad example. But going back to bring in another person, just because I think this is actually very interesting, the new Army of Two game, the next 40 days, is that what its subtitle is?
Something like
Something
that.
like
I think it's
something like
called
that.
Army of Two.
Yeah.
Let's get fish bumpy.
So here's the interesting thing, right? Alex Hutchinson, who was at EA for a while, EA Redwood Shores, he's now working on that game. Mm-hmm. And he gave a great talk at GDC about social mechanics and social interactions in games. Mm-hmm. And the next Army 2 game is apparently going to have, you know, some big, you know, ethical type decisions to make. Yeah. Except the decision is made between the two players. Huh, completely external to the game. So either of the characters can make like a decision, you know, if it's like help or kill someone, like mm-hmm. either of them can kill that person. And then it is entirely the two players' social interaction to determine how they actually resolve that problem.
So it's kind of like a couch diplomacy type situation. Like you actually have to turn to your person and be like, all right, like don't shoot him. And then you'll have to argue back and forth whether or not to do it.
Right.
Huh. That's good. I wonder how... In that case, how do we draw the line as to where the game is forcing us to do that and where the players themselves, like their personalities, like what is most responsible in that situation?
Yeah, and I don't know exactly where that plays out. Like, obviously, the game can sort of set... I think the best way to do it is not to enforce it through some mechanic like, you know, both players hit A to confirm their decisions or something like that. That, you know, you can sort of create these moments. Mm-hmm. And if they happen with some people, awesome. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, just the more brash person just picks the decision, mm-hmm. then that will have to work its way out too. But it's like more, you know, mechanisms and systems like that that lead me to believe that this is a much more solvable problem when you have more than one, you know, human thinking mind in the equation.
Yeah, I mean, the more players there are, just the more chaos there can be, and so you don't have to have a narrative or a set of play mechanics that can outsmart a player. It can use people's natural tendency to kind of disagree with each other as a way of enforcing this permanence, which is kind of weird because, you know, it means the most perfect way that a single player could do it would be to simulate having another person there that you'd have to get along with, because it seems like that's what Army of Two is trying to do, you know, trying to simulate the idea of how hard it is to make an ethical decision when you have to think about someone other than yourself making it. A consensus based way of making a decision is harder than making a unilateral one.
Right, exactly. I mean, and you know, if it were somehow possible to get every player to emotionally invest in every character in a game, mm-hmm. then, you know, a lot of these decisions would necessarily be a lot more poignant and resonant. That's not the case, and I don't know if, like, having better characterizations and better stories and all that kind of stuff, is that going to do it? Maybe. Yeah.
We won't.
I'm sure it won't hurt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's a good point. I mean, we won't really know. The problem is that I think we won't really know if that works until we get to a level where the acting and the writing in video games is kind of more on par with other media that we see. But we might not want to get to that point because, and this is what Clint Hawking might say, we wouldn't want to get to that point because that means we would stop focusing on things games can do uniquely and instead just focus on aping movies or something like
that. That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. I don't ever, I mean, you know, this is totally paraphrasing Clint, but I don't want it to be the case where the interesting, you know, heavy, meaningful, artistic stuff happens in the cutscenes and with the voice actors and what the game designers do is just the filler in between. Mm-hmm. I don't want that to be, you know, my labors. And if that were the case, I might have to start doing something else.
Yeah, because you'd be serving, I mean, you would basically be serving these characters rather than serving the players, you know? I mean, it would be, you'd be working towards something that isn't really interactive, which is kind of blasphemy as far as what a game actually is.
Yeah.
Right.
Do we want to talk about BioShock at all? It's kind of a can of worms, but what do you want to say about BioShock?
Okay, well, here's the thing.
Yeah.
The multiplayer aspect of it is really interesting because I think that when you have another person there, you're bringing in not only just what you think the other person will do and the bickering that will go on between two players, which happens all the time, I think you also have some sort of real world ethics weighing down on you, as if you have to behave a certain way because someone is watching you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I don't know how many people this actually affects, but I wonder if you got your significant other watching you play a game, maybe a violent game, do you tone down the violence you're doing?
Well,
do you change how you play so that they see your in-game decision making match up with your real life decision making?
So they don't think they're sleeping with a sociopath.
I've actually heard some people say that in respect to BioShock and other stuff. So there's actually a very interesting scene in BioShock, kind of late in the game, that does this. So just after the confrontation with Ryan, you end up in like Tenenbaum's nursery the or whatever.
Type thing,
And if you've been helping little sisters by and large, you know, it's a very open, well-lit, you know, pleasant area. There are little, you know, blocks and other toys around. All the little sisters run up and like thank you and say, oh, you know, he's the one that saved us. But if you've been harvesting them, there are far fewer girls. It's really dark. When you look at them, they like, you know, edge up back against the wall. They like whisper to each other like, he's the one who hurts us.
Yeah, that's terrible.
And like that moment was, I mean, obviously, like the first time you harvest or save, you know, those first few times that decision is made, it's like still kind of a big deal. But once you've done it like 15 times, it sort of loses its affect. But that nursery scene, when I played the game, you know, entirely through both ways, all saving and all harvesting, and the second time when I actually saw that scene was different, I was like, whoa. That's actually well done.
You feel bad a little bit.
Even though it's just polygons and stuff.
So having that kind of feedback, because in a lot of games, you know, the bad or the aggressive or whatever, if you make that decision, the outcome is just people are going to try to attack you and kill you. But the problem is that is the primary form of interaction in these games anyway, right? So you get more experience, money, ammo, whatever. So basically, if you make the quote-unquote bad decision, the character really is just getting more resources.
That's the thing where it becomes an optimization thing rather than, you know, a moral dilemma.
So having like some feedback in the world that is negative, but that isn't, you know, just violent or aggressive, I think that can also help give these things a lot more weight. Fallout 3 actually does this very well with the character of Three Dog. I wrote about this in my blog, calling him a procedural scald, but you know, as you make decisions in the game, he kind of acts sort of as a conscience a little bit, where if you've been doing terrible stuff on the radio, he's like, you know, the Wanderer from Vault 13, he's a monster. He's not Vault 13. Now I'm calling back to the first game. 101. There we go. So having that kind of feedback in the world where if you know, it's not that your decisions are made in isolation and then that's it. That being able to get feedback that isn't just, you know, more fighting or not fighting, I think is something that could be pushed a lot harder.
Yeah, I agree. That's a really good point.
It's one of those things where sometimes BioShock would be criticized because of the little sister choice not meaning anything or not meaning much in terms of the results, like in the gameplay. Like a lot of people have seen that graph at the Escapist where it shows that the variance between saving the little sisters and harvesting the little sisters is actually relatively slim. But people, to a certain point, would criticize that for saying, well, you know, this choice is meaningless. It doesn't really do anything. There's no consequences for it. But what we were just talking about is an example of when outside ethics come into the game. And I think that just because there's not necessarily a gameplay difference there, you can't discount that as a meaningless choice because we don't operate in a vacuum. Like when we're playing a game, we're still carrying all of the years of social pressure that we have been brought up, you know, for good and bad. I mean, like when I first played BioShock, I did it the good way because, you know, I didn't really want to be I didn't really want to be the guy that was like destroying little girls. And that wasn't because I didn't really know what the gameplay ramifications would be at the end. But what I did know is that Rapture has fallen apart, and the reason Rapture fell apart was because of selfish individualism. And so I was like, well, you know, in that case, maybe I shouldn't do this. And so it's kind of this combination of outside socialization with in-game cues. And even though if there's no major mechanical difference, at the end of the day, it can still be useful to have that kind of a choice. It doesn't mean it's a meaningless one, in my view.
Yeah.
Right. I think the problem there isn't that the the rewards were roughly balanced. It's what Clint called ludonarrative dissonance, mm-hmm. in that the game story says, if you're selfish, mm-hmm. you're going to get more rewards, but you're doing this bad thing. Mm-hmm. But then the game's mechanics are saying, you get the same either way, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So obviously, we don't need to talk about ludonarrative dissonance much beyond that. Beyond to say, I think it is a real thing.
Yeah.
And even if people don't recognize it like consciously and think, okay, well, if I optimize this, they can recognize these things subconsciously. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time, and you should at least consider that when you're sort of building these decisions.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, when I was playing through, I was under the illusion that my decision would have been better if I had harvested the girls in terms of the mechanics, the gameplay wise. Mm-hmm. For me, the illusion was enough. I mean, maybe I internalized, as you say, maybe I was seeing ludonarrative dissonance without recognizing it as such. But again, I mean, for me, it was good enough. I mean, at some point,
right.
If I don't know the outcome, and I also feel like you were saying, mm-hmm. even if we were to not get any Adam, if we were harvesting the girls and the game got that much harder, I think I would have continued saving the little girls regardless.
Mm-hmm. Just
because of my desire not to hurt little children.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe I would.
Although,
yes.
I was going to say that I'd argue that if that was the case, and then you recognized that the game was getting significantly harder, and it would have been easier if you'd done the more selfish thing, mm-hmm. that might have been a little more resonant than
been tempted.
You're right. Yeah. I would have been tempted. Well, yeah, it's interesting though, because I think I still was tempted, or I think you're right, Niles. I think you're right, because it wasn't significantly harder.
Yeah, and I mean, this is super subjective too, right? It's not like this quality that everyone will recognize and see. Mm-hmm. Some people notice it, some people don't. But I think enough people do, either actively or sort of when they're thinking about it later or whatever, that it's something that we need to regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people go into games ready and willing to leave out real-world ethical decisions from their gameplay because it's relatively
easy. It's an
escape,
almost.
Yeah. I mean, I can separate what's going on. I can play through BioShock again, mm-hmm. and harvest all of the little girls, and I've got no qualms about it. I've already seen the good side, and it's exploring the bad side.
Yeah.
So,
right.
I mean, it's hard because I don't know how you usher a group of players through an ethical decision when you're not sure of their own personal ethics, of how they're approaching the game, mm-hmm. of whether or not permanence is even going to matter to them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right.
The other thing about that is that is it enough for the ethical decision to simply be presented and have to have the player struggle through it? So let's say what if that there is this huge ethical decision and in the end it really didn't matter. Does that lessen its impact? Because are we saying that the way we arrive at the ethical decision is less important than its ultimate impact? Or can it be enough to have a struggle making a decision and then have it mean nothing? Because that's what happens in life a lot, too. Like, you agonize over these decisions, and then it just means nothing in the end.
Right.
And so maybe that's just too depressing to have in games. Like, maybe it's so... That's too depressing to even have in a game because it mirrors real life too much and it's annoying.
Maybe.
Because I don't know. Like I feel like go ahead.
I think with that, like if you can smoke and mirrors it enough that it feels like it's a really big deal, but things turn out the same way either way. Like if you can pull it off, that's great. But if you don't pull it off, then it becomes really, really transparent. Mm-hmm. Everyone sees the man behind the curtain, and they're like, okay, this is lame.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's, like, the culture and community around the discussions of games. And very quickly, people at large will kind of figure out that these things don't matter.
Yeah.
And someone playing it later will go in knowing full well that, you blow up the world, you save the world. Either way, the same thing actually happens.
Yeah, that's true. I guess there has to be either you have to completely isolate yourself from anyone talking about it, or they actually do have to have some kind of meaning at the end.
Yeah.
So yeah. are you, I mean, as you develop games, as you continue on through your craft, are you, how are you taking these things into consideration? Like when you sit down to like think about a problem in a game, do you consciously think about this kind of stuff, or is it something that you look back after you create something and then kind of tweak it to make it seem like a bigger decision or a more subtle decision? Has this come up a lot as you've been making games?
Not particularly. It at least partially because the types of games we make are, you know, they're more comedic, right?
Yeah.
They're not super heavy serious games. Mm-hmm. You know, we do think a lot about like the kind of decisions people make. They're not necessarily decisions that are anchored in the narrative, but it's still like gameplay type decisions where, you know, it's like if they're taking this suite of abilities instead of this suite of abilities, you know, how do we inform the players that this one kind of has these consequences, this one has these kinds of consequences, that kind of stuff. So it's not like an ethical decision, but it's still like a big decision. And it has that crossover in that, in both cases, both the ethical decisions and more gameplay type decisions, you want to give the players a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of contentious. Some people think that it's better, and kind of Manveer said this, that you don't want to telegraph the outcomes of the decisions too much.
Yeah.
And while I think that's true, you also don't want to have these kind of decisions where the player's going to have no idea what's going to happen. Yeah, it's related to that. Like, you know, if they're, well, last time I wanted this to happen, but this completely different thing happened, then my decisions don't matter.
Right, in which case regret might be good enough to just stop playing.
Exactly. And that, I mean, that's sort of like, that's what railroading is in a tabletop RPG, where the players don't have decisions, or the decisions they have don't actually make a difference. Mm. And that, you know, like, as far as like game masters go, that's like one of the gravest sins you could commit, right? But games do it all the time.
Yeah,
and
true.
I mean, it is just like a technology, you know, scope issue.
Mm-hmm.
That when it's just, you know, when the only resources you have are imaginations, then obviously you got to do whatever you want.
Yeah, that's true. So do you think that there's certain games that either will do this more effectively in the future, or if there's certain types of genres that are more conducive to doing this? Like, could you see one of your games that you're working on do this kind of, even if it's in a comedic way, like have a decision that means a lot to a player? Or do you think it's more conducive in a game that's a first person thing, or do you think it's more conducive in a adventure game?
I think in general, I mean, of course, like there's plenty of space for games that don't have this sort of big decision type making. They can just be, you know, fun, and that's awesome.
Like Bit Trip Beat
Pagel.
That's right. I've been playing Trine. There aren't many big decisions to make in there. It is good. Sorry, but anyway, I think that in, you know, basically any game that really is about creating an experience rather than, you know, having fun or, you know, succeeding, fulfilling goals, when it's more experiential, that these kind of more meaningful decisions are important. And it isn't just the domain of the RPG or the first person shooter or something like that. But this is something that, you know, lots of games ought they would be more affecting if they did more of these things better. I mean, of course, like if it were easy, if we knew how to do it, then lots of people would just do it. Like,
yeah.
We wouldn't have a podcast.
Yeah.
Right.
So is there anything else you guys wanted to bring up before we kind of wrap this discussion up for now? I mean, there's, like Nils was just saying, there's no easy answers, but is there anything else we kind of skipped over that you might want to bring up?
I'm happy with that. I think the feedback thing is a really good, important thing that Nels mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially in terms of applying that to other genres and other games that may not even be normally compatible with this sort of ethical decision, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it is a big, hard problem, but a very interesting one, and I'm glad that lots of very smart people are thinking about it, and I will continue to think about it and make my own meager contributions.
Well, I mean, we thank you for coming on the podcast. I mean, it was you're the inaugural guest on the Experience Points podcast.
Oh, thank you very much, guys. It is an awesome show, an awesome site. I'm really, really glad that you guys are doing what you do, and that you keep doing it so well.
Oh, careful. We'll get big heads.
Yeah, it's a low stress around here. For those of you looking to learn more about what Nils does, above49.ca is his website. He writes about everything from game design to, you know, current games that he's been playing. I mean, is there anything else you wanted to put in there, like what you've been up to, certain games that we should be looking out for, certain posts that you like everyone to read?
Tweeps you want to shout out to, maybe?
Yeah, tweeps.
Tweeps. I mean, there's this massive community, and anyone who's sort of in this area is familiar with it, but it's sort of got anchored around Mike Abbott's Brainy Gamer site, mm-hmm. and there's just this web of lots and lots of people who are writing far more intelligently and far more, you know, eloquently about games than I am. So, you know, just for any of our blogs, just follow the links, look for the other folks. You know, there are tons and tons of really, really good people doing awesome work in the space of games, and they don't get the attention that they deserve, in my opinion.
That's true. Yeah. I actually have to tell you something, Niles. I thought that your blog Above 49 was called such because you were over 50.
Awesome! Awesome! Yeah. No. It is because the Western Canada and the United States, the border is at the 49th parallel.
Mm-hmm. I am now more educated than
I was. Like George, you were like reading his website, like, wow, this guy's pretty smart for an old guy. Like, yeah, I can't believe this. Like,
all right. Well, also, if anyone's listening and you'd like to start by our own blog, again, the website is experiencepoints.blogspot.com. We encourage you to leave your comments, and we update Monday, Wednesday, and Friday evenings.
All right. Until next time. Nels, thanks again for being on.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
All right. And for everyone out there, have fun.
Bye-bye. Every time we